Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Manual Therapy Blog. This is Matt, as always, the host of all these different interviews and podcasts and things that we get to do. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with the one and only Diane Lee, a physiotherapist out of Canada. And if you're a follower of manual therapy in terms of manual physical therapy, you probably have heard of her at some point, read an article, read a couple of her books, or at least seen them. So it's quite a pleasure to get to speak with her and learn a lot of different things from her in this conversation that you're about to listen to. Diane Lee in the past might be most notable for her contributions as an author to books called The Pelvic Girdle and The Thorax, as well as a more recent publication that is centered around diastasis rectus abdominis. Diane Lee is very active within the continuing education realm of manual physical therapy or manual physio, and she teaches a model called the integrated systems model. And during our conversation, you get to learn a little bit more about what that means to her and what she tries to emphasize within this model and what she wants to impart onto other clinicians whenever she gets to educate them during her lengthy travels. Another fun thing that we get to hear from Diane is a lot about her personal views regarding manual therapy. And a lot of that is centered around the fact that it is an art. What we do with our hands and how we work with patients is an art form. It's a craft. It's not something that can be learned easily. It's not something that can be taught in just a weekend or just by reading journal articles or, you know, seeing things online. So it's really something that takes a lot of dedication and time and extra work to get good at. And that's one of the things that she imparts to us in this interview that we got to do. Hopefully all of you out there enjoy this as much as I did. It's always a pleasure to get to speak with Diane. If you've had the pleasure of actually taking a course from her or know of anybody that has taken a course from her, it's quite an exciting experience overall. And as we always say, you know, if you enjoy what you're hearing with this interview or with anything that we get to do, or if you enjoy seeing or reading anything from our site, please share it with others. Please share it with your friends or colleagues, and not just, you know, on email or referring them, you know, to the website, but share it on Facebook or Twitter. Retweet it, share it, all those different things that we can get to do. And along those same lines, if you have any suggestions, I'm always open to that, so please let me know. Shoot me an email or write a comment on the page for this particular post, or shoot me a message on Twitter or Facebook, either way. And we just appreciate you guys listening and following along. So, without further ado, here's Diane Lee. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is Diane Lee. I don't think she needs much of an introduction, so Diane, can you just mention briefly what we were just talking about, you know, kind of off the air?
Yeah, I sure can, Matt. Thanks for having me. So I've been a manual therapist, orthopedic manual therapist now for close to 40 years, and I've been involved in the orthopedic division and also in NIOP to a lesser extent in terms of training and examining young practitioners. What's concerned me probably over the last 10 to 15 years is the lack of interest of our graduate physical therapists in doing the time, doing their due diligence, putting in the work that it really takes to train our hands to be the meaningful tools that they can be. I don't think that we get or have time to have this training in our undergrad programs. There's so many other things to learn in an evidence-based practice, which is mandated that our programs need to be. But the clinical skill of sort of developing the ability to accurately perceive things with your hands is not, doesn't seem to be presented there. And you can't get it from online courses. You can't learn how to use your hands from reading a book. It's in-class work. You need good mentorship, and you have to do the time. And I can see people are diverting to quicker, more apparently simple ways of doing it, using their hands, and not very well. And what concerns me even more is if they don't get great success with it, but they seem to think that they can be involved in research with it, but they don't know how to use their hands very well, and the results are showing it because they're not reliable. And we can talk about reliability in a moment, a bit about that. I've got some exciting news for you with respect to manual palpation skills and reliability from some studies I've been involved with. But bottom line being, it takes time to train your hands, and we're seeing a drop-off in Canada here of people actually going through our whole training program.
Really?
And I think it's happening worldwide, right?
Wow, that's somewhat disappointing to hear, because I've been going through the North American Institute's curriculum, and as you're well aware, and as some listeners might be aware, is a lot of that is based on Canadian system, so to speak. And because, you know, a lot of the Canadian guys were the ones who came up with NIOP. And I see a great benefit to that in the information that is taught. And so that's disappointing to hear. It's kind of hitting a drop-off in Canada, because there's so much knowledge and skill that is helpful to patients that if clinicians aren't willing to receive it, that to me, their patients aren't receiving the benefit.
Well, I see two problems in terms of over the long term what's happened to it. So years and years ago, Australia mandated that the manual therapy programs be linked to universities. Canada didn't make that decision in the 70s. And so we've had, you know, focused interest groups like the orthopedic division and special non-university linked groups take on the majority of the training. And it's only been in the last decade or so that we've had one school in Canada, the University of Western Ontario, actually take on a program, a master's degree program for manual therapy. Now, Carol Kennedy has headed up a curriculum that's about to start, it's just starting this year actually at UBC. But when we went from a bachelor's degree entry level in our profession to a master's degree, and for you guys in the States, the DPT, mm-hmm. What happened with that is it delayed the entry level of individuals into specialization programs. So if you don't actually graduate with your entry degree until you're 27 or 28 years old, people aren't going to be inclined, especially women, aren't going to be inclined at that age to go back and to do 4 or 5 years more training.
Yeah.
And why do I want to go and do a master's degree program in manual therapy if I've already got a master's degree from my entry level in physiotherapy, as it's called up here? So the switching of the entry level of the degree, I think, was a deterrent for some people. And also the requirements, the mentorship requirements, has become more and more difficult as people started working more in, you know, the private sector and not necessarily being working together in larger teams to provide the mentorship requirements that IFOMP requires. So there's a financial commitment, there's a time commitment, and with the access of dry needling and people seeing the success they get with dry needling and the whole movement. This is another topic, Matt, but it's one I'm really passionate about. The whole movement away from biomechanics in movement, I just don't understand it. Mm-hmm. The biomechanics aren't important, that the bio and the biopsychosocial is not important, that mm-hmm. there's no correlation that's been found between pain, alignment, and position. And that seems to be used as evidence to absolutely diss anything that's biomechanical in nature, when for me biomechanics is the fundamental movement knowledge that needs to underpin our profession and all we do. If we don't understand how movement is to occur in an efficient way that doesn't stress tissue and is optimized over the longer period of time, I wouldn't know how to practice. I'm at a loss for words when people, you know, throw evidence that they say to me, well, you believe some evidence, you don't believe others. But when you read the evidence that pertains to alignment work or posture work, it's not that good.
And, it's hard to be objective, too.
Yeah, totally, totally. And, I mean, we all have bias, that's for sure. Because I see phenomenal results in my practice that I can't deny by helping people move better, through better alignment, through better posture and movement strategies. And so I don't, and even when people in yoga say, well, you know, we don't work on alignment. Alignment is not great. We just move people. Well, certainly you couldn't do tree pose if your thorax couldn't line up over your pelvis, over your foot. Isn't that cueing alignment?
Yeah.
Isn't that biomechanics?
Yeah.
So I get lost in the language a little bit, but.
And that's one thing that I really appreciate about some of my background with Institute of Physical Art, because in kind of my interpretation, as I get to be an instructor with them, and just the whole thing between structure and function, if, as you're saying, alignment and movement, if you're not able to perform a movement or a meaningful task with proper alignment or proper posture, you go in and you assess different tissues, different regions, and other things to see if there's a mechanical limitation. If there is, then you use manual therapy to get things in proper position. If there isn't, then you train them to maintain a proper position or move in and out of that same thing with appropriate control. And I think it's just gotten away from, in my eyes or in my mind, what manual therapy is used for. It's a means to get people to move better. It's not what I think some people are calling it, where it's just this magical tool. And, you know, we don't think of it as that, but it's a means to an end.
Yeah, actually, and it's only one component part of our treatment session, right? In terms of we use our hands to change the sensory input into the nervous system to get a different motor output. I would agree the days are gone when we're thinking that, you know, you manipulate adhesions and they free up and all of a sudden the world's a happy place. That's not how it works. Now, it doesn't mean we toss out the manipulation technique. I mean, I think the mechanisms by which we explain how things are working have certainly evolved and changed over 20, 30 years. But the fact that the manual therapy technique has played a role in affecting change in the person's movement behavior is clear. I mean, countless clinicians witness it day in and day out. Maybe we explain it all different ways, but you know, it's clear that something good is happening. Otherwise, people wouldn't, you know, maintain using it. But the other there was another point that you had mentioned, and it's just eluded me for a moment when you were talking about movement. Remind me again what you were just talking about with respect to the manual therapy.
Well, I was just saying in terms of in my background and training with the Institute of Physical Art that we try and distinguish structure and function and how the two are really the opposite sides of the same coin.
And the point that I wanted to make is that we don't decide as clinicians where the best place is to intervene in the body, whatever you want to call it. Regional interdependence is what Josh Cleland calls it. Finding the driver is what I call it in the integrated systems model. It's just language. It doesn't matter. When you have multiple impairments in the body, an old sprained ankle, a couple of vaginal deliveries with poor pelvic control, a whiplash and in your neck, how they all relate together and where to start to help this person be better in their body, we call it finding the driver. It's not me that makes the decision based on watching how you move and how I think you should move. I think this is a really critical point. Mm. When you intervene in the body and you make a correction, so you stack the foot or you align the foot or you control the pelvis or you do something in the thorax to change its center of mass over the body's base of support, the person themselves will experience a difference. Their feedback to you in terms of how they control the rest of their body and how they feel with it guides the intervention. So the patient is a really key player in this. It's not me having some presumptive idea of that there's only one way to move. Heaven forbid, we know that that's not true. Mm-hmm. But by testing the patient in front of you, you'll be able to figure out fairly quickly, where do I start? Where do I go? And how does it unravel from here? And that is the art. I mean, I love the name that Greg and Vicky picked for their program, the Institute of Physical Art, because there is an art to this. There's that science has a hard time measuring because there's so many variables that we have to control or account for, not control, we have to consider in every treatment session, and that's just the fact of our reality, right?
Yep.
It's totally.
And I think the balance between art and science is really, it's always the pendulum, you know, right? In terms of manual therapy, which way is it swinging at any given time? And right now, you know, some people, rightly so, feel like it's swung way too far over towards the science side, and you're losing that art form of what is manual therapy. And hopefully, I believe in things like that that always come back around, that eventually you'll see it swing back to an art form in people. It's a craft where you have to work at it, it takes time, and mentoring goes a really long way.
It does. Now, it was really exciting at the World Congress on Low Back and Pelvic Pain, Andre Vleming's conference in Singapore last November, to hear almost every single presenter talk about how the RCT is not the best way to measure what we're doing in the clinic, and that individualized programs which follow a clinical reasoning protocol is going to be the way forward. Fabulous, fabulous.
Yeah.
But what was not mentioned is, and how do we do it? Yeah. How do we clinically reason through the multitude of findings that we get? And so this is where I think that, you know, programs like IPA and the NIOPT and, you know, the integrated systems model are, even though we don't necessarily have evidence that backs our specific approach, there's evidence to back a clinical reasoning approach on a go-forward basis. How do we make sense of all the knowledge that there is in our profession and apply it to the individual person sitting in front of us?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's been my bugbear for a long time about intertestor reliability studies in the pelvis. So the research on pelvic biomechanics, and particularly the clinical application of what we understand the biomechanics to be in the pelvis, is absolutely forestalled because Andre Vleming doesn't believe that we can reliably feel active mobility in the sacroiliac joint. And so until we have people, until we can have a test that has shown intertestor reliability for making a decision about whether the joint is moving or not, we're not going to have any more clinical studies that show that we can even test it. And if you can't test active mobility of a joint that's moving, well, then you can't do a clinical trial on anything about the pelvis. So 2 years ago, Joe Abbott, who is a biomechanist from Bournemouth, did the series with me, the ISM series, and she is currently doing her PhD on pelvic biomechanics. And she really took up the challenge on a lot of things I say about why intertestor reliability studies show that we're not reliable. And after 40 years of teaching people how to feel movement in the pelvis, it's been my clinical and teaching observation that some people see things differently than they feel. Some people feel things differently than they see. And when you examine the tester, the person whose eyes and hands don't match is the person who has a lot of problems between their cranium and their upper thorax. So I had said to Joe, my suspicion is that people who have their upper thoracic rings, so second, third thoracic rings that are, say, are rotated to the left, but they've got something going on in the cranium and the cranio-vertebral region that holds them rotated to the right, and it causes the sphenoid to rotate. And so one eye is a little bit deeper in the orbit than the other. My prediction would be that these people, reliability is really tough because their eyes are seeing things a different way than what they feel. And no study yet for intertestor reliability has separated vision from kinesthetic sense.
Yeah.
We don't know whether testers are looking at their thumbs, looking at their hands, whether they're just feeling, what are they doing? So we designed a study to be published at the end of her series on day 15, basically where we compared vision to manual palpation. So you either watched another therapist's hands, or you were blinded, couldn't see, and you just used your hands. And we landmarked the anonymous with the person in sitting. So this wasn't about making a judgment or a decision about the pelvis. It's like, just what do you feel with your hands? Where are they? Which is one rotated more than the other? And then we correlated both intra and intertester reliability statistical analysis, and Joe did a whole bunch of qualitative questionnaire things, thematic, mixed methods review is what she did. Bottom line is this: if you have a twist between your upper thorax and your cranium, your ability to see what you feel is no better than random.
Wow.
However, if your cranium and your upper thorax are in alignment, in good alignment, then your results are absolutely, I can't remember the number, but a whole lot better than random. So we now know that unless the testers who are doing these studies are screened for head and neck impairments, they're gonna mix up the results because they don't see what they feel. And unless you separate vision from touch, they're going to make a judgment based on one or the other, and that judgment's going to be random. Hmm. Oh, it's a really, really cool study, Matt. Because yeah, now what the implication is not that we can't feel what we're feeling. We can, but how we interpret it depends on what we see and the relationship between what we see and what we feel and which one you default to. So as we get more studies on our testers, we'll get more information on why some people are not reliable. And if we screen them out and we only have testers that can see what they feel and can feel what they see, then I think our reliability is going to be much better.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. How did
cool,
you...
Cool, hey?
Yeah, I mean, who came up with that design study? Was that just your idea and she figured out how to study it?
Yeah, I mean, I just said to Joe, there's people who can't see what they feel, and if I take their eyes out of the equation and I only let them use their hands, and they have to, and the other thing is the persons who only use their fingers and their thumb, so this is palpating a nominate, okay? Mm-hmm. So if you only use one part of your hand, just a thumb, so many studies have shown we're not reliable with that. Because when you look at the robotics research of the information that comes from our hands, it's quite fascinating, actually. The thumb is a spatial orientator. It needs another part of your hand in relationship to it to know where anything is. So to just put your thumb on something, you have no idea where it is. Mm. Your fingers are very much your braille walkers. So they walk around the structure to get its shape, to know where it is. You know these people who you always, these therapists that you train, and you always want them to stop moving your hands. Stop it. Stop moving your hands. Just keep your hands still. Mm-hmm. These are the people that have intuitively figured out that to use their fingertips and to walk around a bone or whatever it is, they get a better sense of the shape of it. Ideally, what we need to do is use our whole hand, the palm of your hand, fingertips, and thumb. Rest on the structure, and then all the information will go into your awareness. So those who did not use their entire hand didn't have results better than random, and those who had twists in the upper thorax. So there's a lot of really good information in this. And these were just my clinical observations from how to teach people to reliably feel the same thing. So in our classes, we do a lot of inter-tester reliability and help people know what is their most reliable perception. Because this is how you develop your manual skills. Mm-hmm. How do I know what I'm feeling? And how do I interpret what I'm feeling? Because you can't interpret a finding. You can't find. And unfortunately, a lot of the people that are researching some of the things that I've developed and I've done can't do it. They haven't taken the time to develop their hands to actually find the finding. If you can't find it, how can you research it?
Exactly. And of course, because they can't feel it or they can't find it, then they believe no one can.
Exactly. You got it. And it's, you know, the comment's so interesting. When people start, they go, oh my gosh, that's so subtle. Mm-hmm. And you go, it's only subtle because your brain map for this experience is really small right now. But as you feel more and different people and different shapes, let's say in the thorax, different shapes of the thorax and different amounts of movement, your brain map for this tool, this test, will get bigger. And as your brain map gets bigger for it, your ability to perceive differences will be more sensitive. That's just neuroplasticity principles. And we apply it to manual therapy as much as we apply it to movement. How do we develop the neuroplasticity of sensations in the hand? Tons of research in violinists that have looked at the brain map for the hand that is on the neck of the violin, the strings of the violin versus on the bow. Right, in terms of that hand, the homunculus, the real estate that hand takes in the brain, it just grows. What we pay attention to grows in our brain. So these little subtle thoracic ring shifts become huge, and it only takes a few days, which is what amazes me. I used to get very frustrated on day one of courses, and now I just sit back and I just wait. By day four, people are finding findings reliably. I mean, we're always mixing people up, getting their findings tested, and trying to figure out if somebody is is off a lot. Why are they off? What's going on? And how they can calibrate their body or change their body position in order to become more reliable. And then with the end result being, look, you got to get yourself fixed if you want to. You got to get some treatment if you want to use manual work in your practice. I mean, if you want to dry needle and move, or if you want to just use education, then you don't really need to interpret what you're finding with your hands. But if you want to do this stuff, then you have to be able to accurately perceive perceptions. Yeah.
Yep, that is so true. Diane, I really hate to move away from this, but if you don't mind, can we ask you a few different questions?
Absolutely.
And we'll certainly come back to this, though. I really don't want to leave this completely, but I do want to ask you some questions that, you know, I've gotten to ask a lot of other people that have agreed, you know, to talk with me. And first of all, can you tell us where you're from, where you grew up?
Oh, wow. Well, I was born in Vancouver. Vancouver has been my my hometown all my life. I had a brief period of 8 years where I lived in Kamloops. My dad was in the construction industry, and he moved us to a small town that's about 3.5 hours north and east of Vancouver for 8 years. So I wouldn't say I'm from there. I'm from Vancouver, even though I spent 8 years there. Because as soon as I came back to Vancouver to go to university, I knew I had come home. Every time I fly back here and I fly in and I breathe the ocean mountain air, I go, oh, it's good to be home. So I'm from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Okay. And what was life, you know, like for you growing up? What in terms of a broad sense, you know, what was life like for you? Because I ask that question because for me, if you kind of understand where people come from and their influences in many different ways, you get a glimpse into what makes them who they are today. And so I don't mean that to pry in any way, but just kind of what was life like for you growing up?
So my mom didn't work. She was an at-home mom and a lovely woman, very creative woman, but only had a grade 8 education because her father died when she was 10, and she left school very early to help her mom put her sister through school. So my mom didn't have a high school education. My dad was in construction, and he built houses and apartment buildings and things. And in 1964, the construction industry really fell flat in Vancouver, which is why we moved to the interior. We lived in a very small trailer in a trailer park with a cat and a dog and not a whole lot of money. And I really wanted to join the gymnastics team. I kind of like to stand on my head and do cartwheels and bounce around a bit, but there was no money for that. So I went to work when I was in grade 6 at a 10-pin bowling alley, and I was a pin girl. So I would sit and crouched up on a little bench on the back as these big balls came flying down and all these pins went flying, and then I jumped down into this thing and put the pins back in the bin, and that's how I raised my money to be able to join the gymnastics club in grade 6. So I was a competitive gymnast, went all the way to junior nationals in Canada at the age of 16. And then I had a couple of significant injuries. I had a bad ankle sprain when I was 12. And then I did a back handspring on the balance beam and I landed straddle. And that was the beginning of my pelvic floor problems. Developed urinary incontinence a year later. And following that, dislocated my elbow. All unrelated, of course, but those are all injuries attributed to 6-7 years of pretty high level gymnastics without proper spotting and proper equipment that they have now. But it was through gymnastics that introduced me to physiotherapy. I was introduced to physiotherapy as part of our guidance program in grade 12, and sounded interesting. I had a little bit of it, but all I'd really had was ultrasound on my elbow. I didn't have any treatment for my pelvic floor, didn't have any treatment on my ankle other than a cast. And my real reason for going into physiotherapy was because I wanted a gap year, and my dad wouldn't let me have it. He thought that I should go straight into university. If I had a gap year, I wouldn't go back to school, and I wanted to go backpack through Europe. So what I found out in this guidance year was that there was 800 applications for physiotherapy a year, and only 30 people got in.
Oh, my
gosh.
There's
only one school in BC, and I thought, yeah, this is my way out, right? I can apply, not get in, and then I got my gap year. I got in. So now what am I going to do? Am I going to lie to my father and say, it was all a ruse, I don't want to do this? Or do you just suck it up and go take the punishment that you signed yourself up for? I hated physiotherapy school. I thought the only thing I liked about it was anatomy and and neural anatomy. Now, you got to remember, this is 1973, 74, and physiotherapy in those days was real about pounding chests, fitting crutches, moving toes. Manual therapy hadn't even arrived in Canada then. It was not till 1976, 77 when they had that famous meeting at the Canary Islands. So we didn't have anything in terms of manual therapy at that time. Yeah. And so after a year of doing hospital rounds when I graduated, I was a pretty unhappy camper. I contacted Myra Thomas at the Workers' Compensation Board, and I said, if you don't get me out of this hospital, I'm going to quit. I am absolutely not going to continue this profession. So I went to the Workers' Compensation Board. I worked there for a year. Hated it. All we did was ultrasounds and hot packs. All the exercise stuff happened downstairs with the remedial gymnasts. Physios just did modalities. That's all we did.
Oh, wow.
Actually, the physiotherapists just did crossword puzzles. They didn't do anything. And there was a couple of people there who were actually interested in the profession, and one was Marilyn Atkins. So I kind of sidled up to Marilyn. She was getting involved in the Canadian system at the time. And it was a year after that that I had the opportunity to go and work with Cliff Fowler. And that was practice-saving, profession-saving, my life-saving experience was the year and a half that I got to have a mentor like Cliff, who really ignited a passion in me for helping people. And he taught me how to learn from people, learn from patients, how to be critical of things that I was reading, things that I was saying. And it was, it certainly was a pivotal point. And probably the only reason I'm still a physiotherapist today is because of that year and a half working with Cliff. And then I met Earl Pettman and John Oldham, David Lamb, all at that same time, who were pioneers certainly in my country, in Canada, for what manual therapy looks like in this country today.
Yeah. Well, Diane, can you tell us a story about how you got in with Cliff, how you got that year and a half with him.
Well, he was actually in private practice with Alan Morgan, who's long gone now, but Alan and Cliff kind of had a duplex practice set up. So they shared a waiting room, they each had their own receptionist, and they had four or five treatment rooms, no exercise, but four or five treatment rooms in the back. And Alan got sick. He had spinal stenosis and MS, I believe, if I remember right. And he needed some time off. And I was scheduled to actually go work for John Oldham. I had accepted a job with John. But John and Cliff started talking, and Cliff said, Alan really needs somebody to run his practice. I haven't a clue how to run his practice. So Cliff told Alan that he would look after the financial and the administrative aspects of it, and that I would manage the patients. And so all of a sudden I wasn't working for John anymore. I was driving an hour out to Surrey in my little Honda Civic. And I can never forget my first afternoon there. I arrived at 2 o'clock and I was booked till 5. And I had 19 patients booked. And I looked at this and I went, you must be joking. You must be joking. And he says, Cliff says, yeah, and if you have any trouble with any of them, just sort of, give me a call. Well, what are you going to do? 5-10 minutes with people, you plow your way through. And at the end of it, it was just, I was exhausted. A couple of days later, I was sort of settling into this pace and had a patient that I didn't know what to do with. And so I went and knocked on his door, and he was sitting in his office with his feet up on the desk and, looking at some magazine of some sort. I said, could you come and help me for a minute? He said, sure. So he came in and quickly looked at this person, and he said, do L5, he'll be fine. Do L5? What do you want me to do to it? Like, traction, PA pressure? What do you want to, like, what? And he just looked at me and he went, just do it. And then he left the room, and the patient looked at me and he says, okay, let's do it. And I went, okay. I had no idea what that meant. So after I did whatever I did, I stormed out of there and I went into his office and I just lambasted him and said, if that's the best way that you can mentor someone and tell them what to do, I'm going to be in real trouble. And I can't remember what else I said, but he was still a smoker at the time, and the cigarette fell out of his lips, landed in his lap, and he just looked at me like, what atom bomb has just dropped into my life? And that kind of started our relationships, where he would give me clues, but he wouldn't give me answers, and he would send me home with things to look up, and meanwhile, he'd be on the phone to Earl or John, just telling them about all the many ways he was torturing me, but at the same time, training me in terms of how to learn, how to look things up, what to do, the rest of it. And it was that during that time that this would be 1981, 1982, that he received an invitation from his Churchill Livingston at the time and his good friend Gregory Grieve, who was on the editorial board for Churchill Livingston. And they wanted a clinical book written on the pelvic girdle because Lance Toomey and Nick Bogduck had submitted their proposal for the lumbar spine, but they didn't want to include the pelvis because Nick felt there wasn't enough evidence known about it, so he wasn't going to include it in his book. So they asked Greg, do you know anybody that could write on the pelvis? And he said, yeah, a good friend of mine in Canada is really big into the pelvis. I'll ask Cliff. And Cliff basically said, no, I won't do it, but Diane will. She doesn't have anything to do. So it's a time when my husband was in dental school at the time, and we didn't have kids yet. And so he said, yeah, I think you should take this on. And there's no internet, there was no PubMed, no papers, no access to research at that time. And I had no idea what I was agreeing to, but I would spend every Saturday at the Woodward Library at UBC going through Index Medicus, looking for all the research articles back to 1900, and then go up into the stacks, pull down the volumes of books that had the journal articles in them, stand in line with my nickels in my pocket, nickel per page to photocopy each page. I'd go home maybe after 6 hours work with five articles, read those, go back the next week. It was just phenomenal how much work it took to get all the evidence that had anything with pelvis or SI joint in it from 1900 to 1980.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was sort of the beginning of the opportunity for the first edition of the Pelvic Girdle book. And that was the book that landed on Andre Lemming's desk in 1990, that opened the door for me to be able to have a voice at the World Congress on Low Back and Pelvic Pain, was that little book, The Osteopathic Approach, really, on the pelvis. Yeah.
Wow, okay. those are great stories. I love hearing stuff like that. Now, you mentioned some other people, too, like David Lamb, Earl Pettman, and John Oldham. How did they influence you in those early days?
Well, they were some of the instructors of the, what's called the EV system, extremity vertebral system. The names have changed over time for sure, but they were the lead instructors of the orthopedic manual therapy curriculum in Canada. Mm. And David Lamb, John Oldham, and Cliff were the examiners, the senior examiners at that time. And Earl and I actually did our exams at the same time. Maybe he was one year ahead of me, maybe. And then Earl and I started teaching some courses together, some quadrant courses together in the early 80s. And we were part of a group of people, 15 to 20 people in Canada, who were really responsible for the curriculum development of manual therapy in Canada. And we were finding over time that people were stopping at their manual therapy mobilization exams, and they weren't moving on to their, what we called the B group, which was the manipulation exam. So there was two levels of exams at that time. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, not everybody has the ability to do high speed maneuvers, which is what you need to be a good manipulator, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we would get together, we were doing some training with Lauren Rex down at in URSA, the muscle energy stuff, the osteopathic muscle energy. And as a group, we would go down there. And then there was a few of us, maybe five or seven of us, that had gone all the way through the whole program and were actually, you know, certified manipulative therapists, that we'd go off and get together. And the rest of them that were left there formed this group that they wouldn't tell us what it meant, but the acronym was WGAS, W-G-A-S. And they didn't tell us what it stood for the longest time. And then we finally figured it out after multiple cakes of beer. And what it stood for was, who gives a shit? It was a really, really great times, a group of people that got together and just for the furthering of manual therapy. Those exams, those early exams are gone now. The whole thing is integrated into one program. You don't get your fellowship until you finish the whole thing.
Yeah.
But you know, Matt, it still concerns me that manipulation technique is credited with sort of the highest level of technique. I mean,
right.
You can be a really skilled manual and movement therapist and not use thrust techniques. I think it's just another tool in your toolbox. And I would love to see that change, that it's not all just focused on, you know, the high velocity, low altitude thrust technique, but that clinical reasoning, advanced clinical reasoning and understanding regional interdependence and how different parts of the body work together, I think is as complex a skill as being able to make a joint crack.
Oh, exactly. Yes.
I really think that's a change.
Yeah, and I have to admit, I was a little disappointed whenever I first started going through the NIOP curriculum and heard that they were changing a few things with their certification procedure. And I say disappointed because I'm a traditionalist in a lot of ways. And for those people who came before me who are even mentors to me and have gone through that the way that it used to be, it's like, well, I want to do that. You know, how am I going to measure my skill level or my thinking or reasoning level compared to others if I go through something completely different? And it was, of course, it's not completely different, but they're emphasizing things that are more important now, such as the clinical reasoning. And so that's, you know, appreciated once you kind of step back and go, okay, well, guess it's not so bad.
Clinical reasoning has always been there, but the clinical reasoning has been applied to when should we thrust this joint in a superior glide, when should we thrust this joint in an inferior glide, as opposed to, and when should we not thrust it at all,
right,
as opposed to when should I even treat this joint, when is this joint or this level in the body a victim of an impairment somewhere else. Like, to be able to have tests and tools and ways of looking at the relationship between the body parts and knowing, even for example, let's use a more recent example of isolation training for transversus or multifidus. When is it necessary? So we've seen from the last 20 years of research that if you have an acute back pain episode, that chances are one of your deep muscles somewhere is going to go offline. It's going to be inhibited and may result in atrophy or whatever. I think the research has clearly shown that it's not the same across the board, that motor control strategies vary, they're individual and task specific. So when do we know who needs to have their transversus addressed or deep multifidus addressed and who doesn't? To this date, there still are no studies that have looked at what is the relationship between twists in the thorax and the pelvis. So if your pelvis is rotated to the right because your right hamstrings are pulling more than your quads are, and your thorax is compensating for that and rotating the other way, just to keep it simple, it's not uncommon to see a person in that situation have some delay or change in the recruitment strategy of TA.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the twist out of the system, transversus comes back to what we think is a normal strategy automatically and doesn't need specific training. So there's a subgroup of people with thoracic, lumbar, or pelvic pain who, if you just release in a line, their motor control comes back automatically. And there's another subgroup of people where it doesn't. Those are the ones that need training.
Mm.
Now, if everybody needed their transversus trained in order for their back pain to go away, we wouldn't have gotten anybody better before 1995 because we didn't even do it till then.
Yeah.
And we know that's not true. And that's the beauty that comes with 40 years of doing this, right? That when someone says, every person with back pain has to have their deep multifidus trained, everyone with incontinence has to have their pelvic floor trained. When you recognize that, whoa, hang on, I didn't know anything about how to even assess the pelvic floor before 2000, and I certainly wasn't doing it, and yet people's incontinence was getting better. How does that work? And you begin to realize that, as Laurie Hartman says, nothing is ever and always or never. There's always those people that get better and you may not necessarily be able to explain it, or who don't get better and you not necessarily explain it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the level of understanding that we're getting to now about when to do the things we do is really important. And that's the focus of most of my courses now. And my courses are not about, here's how you do this technique, this is how you do that technique. There's so many courses out there where people can go get the tools in their toolbox for how to do this. I really prefer to focus on when and why and how do you know where to go in the body? When do I take the twist under the cranium? When should I tape the foot? When should I train TA? When should I go to multifidus? And to develop the clinical reasoning skills for knowing when do I use a hands-off approach and just explain pain? When do I talk about gut health and get into the neurotoxins of gluten and dairy? Like where, how, you know, how do you know when it's important to pull that all out?
Yeah.
That's what makes me really passionate these days, is to see clinicians who come with a closet that is so full of knowledge, but so incredibly disorganized, they can't find the left shoe for the right, and how you can help them start to organize their closet of knowledge to know exactly what to do when. Can we ever know exactly? That's too strong a word.
Exactly.
You know, to take some of the assumptions and the guesswork out of our job. To be able to use deductive reasoning, hypothetical reasoning, and to, you know, to test your hypotheses to know this has a good chance of working because da 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 da, as opposed to, well, let's just run with this and see what happens, right?
Yep. Diane, thank you for correcting me. I didn't mean to imply that, you know, North American Institute did not emphasize clinical reasoning before, but you said it, so I don't have to. You further explained what I was trying to say. Thank you also, because you've been basically answering a number of questions I would have asked, so I basically don't have to answer them, or don't have to ask them at this point. But there are some things, just to what you were saying in terms of organization and closet and left shoe from the right shoe. That's one thing that I remember reading about just clinical reasoning in general, is that it's not about how much knowledge you have. It's 'cause we all have... We're all taught a certain set of content within our entry-level programs. And the students that I've gotten to mentor in the clinic or continuing education courses, you know, a lot of them are knowledgeable, but the one thing that they lack is experience, one, but also how to organize that knowledge in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot where mentoring comes in, and you know what you're doing and what other organizations are doing to help people organize that knowledge.
Yeah, so true, so true. And it's, I find it really interesting. I mean, I've never taken any courses in how to educate or how to teach. My education knowledge has just been in the trenches, right?
And
just learned by experience. But what I find is that you can lecture to people on, you know, clinical reasoning, this is how and when you would do that. But then it always surprises me sometime during a course when a penny drops for somebody and they go, oh, this is when I would do that. And in my head, I'm going, haven't I been saying that like 7,000 times since day one? But I haven't said it in a way that's been relevant or has resonated for them in this context.
Yes.
And that's so fascinating to me about how people learn, and what I've really tried to do with both my online education platform and also in class classes is to provide a diversity of ways that people learn. So we know that the worst way to learn is a lecture format, just sit and be lectured to. So I no longer do lectures in classes. They're all online, because then you can go back, you can write notes, you can listen again, you can formulate things, look things up, whatever. But then in class, you have to understand whether somebody is a visual learner and they like to watch demos or see things done, whether they're an auditory learner. I'm certainly not that. Just listen to something and then know it, but some people are.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're a reader, writer, researcher. So there was a fellow on the ISM Head and Neck course in Reston who, as I was lecturing or teaching the course, he was creating this enormous spreadsheet and flow chart, like an algorithm. If this is that, then that goes here, and this box, and capturing things off the handout. And at the end of the four-day course, had this massive spreadsheet flow chart. When I look at it, it just makes me go, whoa, shut that down. But for him, being a reader, writer, researcher, he could read it and see exactly where he would go.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final one is kinesthetic, which I think a lot of physical therapists are. They need to either experience it or feel it in their body.
Yeah.
And so as long as we have, if you can take every key message or thing that you want to teach and make it visual, auditory, write it down, and then more importantly, have them feel it. And that's probably the same with affecting a change in our patients. Hey, you get the people who really get the buy-in and are really committed to doing the things you want them to do, or the people who can feel an immediate change in their body when they do it. So, yeah.
Now, I have a few questions that I do want to get to before our time's up today. So please let me know if you're running out of time, we need to go, because I know we previously talked about when you need to get out of here. But from your background in the Canadian system and what you said very early on in our conversation today in terms of the role for biomechanics in a treatment approach, how has your treatment approach evolved over time? Because that's your early influence. And now you're talking about, you know, a few different things, but still related to biomechanics. I mean, how has that evolved over time? Because now you're also talking about cranial dysfunctions and other things that are mixed in with this whole treatment approach. So how's that changed?
Well, it's just mainly the organization of my closet, right? So when I first started in manual therapy, it was very much a reductionistic approach. So if you have back pain, you look at the back, what's moving, what's not. And what's not moving, you make it move with some manual intervention. And what's moving too much, well, tape it, train it with some kind of exercise. It really wasn't specific. So as time has gone on, probably in the 80s was when we started to look at the impact of other areas of the body on the back. So foot to back, pelvis to back, neck to back, started looking at, and we didn't have the language at that time that we have now in terms of framing it or calling it what it is. But we were certainly looking at the impact of, it was a functional approach in the 80s essentially. And yeah, lots of times Earl would say, don't even ask them about their pain because it's irrelevant. It doesn't relate to it. But if you improve their function, the pain will go away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for peripheral sensitization, that's totally true. Somebody who is centrally sensitized, maybe not so. So, you know, with the evidence and the research that's come in on chronic pain and looking at the neuroscience of pain, things started to change where instead of just looking at the body physically, and having biomarkers or biomechanical markers, we realized that psychology and sociology, so the psychosocial aspect of the experience, was really important as well. So probably in the 90s was where things started to evolve and looking at the impact of our thinking, our memories, our belief system in terms of our habits and movements, and also our social context, our relationships, our immediate relationships in family, our relationships with at work, et cetera, all of those things that sort of evolved in the 90s. So we're looking at the integration of relationships with movement. And then the mid-90s also was where all this specific motor control stuff started to come out with transversus and multifidus in particular. And then in 2000, I really dove deep into more into the pelvic floor and the visceral work. So I did some courses with Jean-Pierre Borel's group in looking at visceral impairments, and it was my hands that took me there. I would be doing joint mobility testing on the sacroiliac joint. I'd do a load, release, and listen for where's the vector pulling me that needs to be released. And this vector is going somewhere towards the uterus. Well, what do I do with that? I had no idea how the uterus was attached to the anatomy and didn't know the anatomy, didn't know anything about it. So took a few courses from the Borel Institute to look at, and a course with Gail Wessler in developing more listening techniques with my hands to, and then integrate it with what I was already doing. And then probably the decade from 1999, I guess, to 2013 was when I was working with LJ. And it was in the writing of the fourth edition of the Pelvic Girdle book that we came up with the name Integrated Systems Model to try and put language to how we were taking all this knowledge and putting it into a system or approach, a clinical reasoning approach that was evidence-informed to guide clinical practice. And so this is where language came around, finding the driver, which is merely the best place to start treating in the body to affect the biggest change, whether there's primary or secondary drivers, and don't really need to get into that language now, but mm-hmm. it was language to explain what it is that we were doing in a very integrated systems approach, looking at how all the different systems were relating to one another. The cranial stuff is really my own. It's my cranial stuff in the integrated systems model is I have personally developed. So it's not like the Upledger stuff. It's not like the Borel stuff at all. It really is about corrections, release and listen, finding vectors between the neck and the cranium, finding vectors within the cranium and the dura and stuff. That really has evolved from applying the same principles that were developed in the thorax and the pelvis to another canister being the cranium. And again, it's just, I mean, you learn so much from teaching and from working with other people, right? So I'm just a learning sponge, I suppose. I love to continue to learn and explore and share with people and learn from people. And there's still lots more to do, but wow. Does that help? Give you a bit of a guideline as to things went?
Yes, that's perfect. do you have any major influences nowadays? Like who or what might be a big influence for you, you know, now?
Oh yeah, still several people. Like who would you know?
Well, it doesn't matter who we know or not, but that's just curiosity.
I don't really know. Sorry, my dog is barking. Okay, they're settled down. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So who's my biggest influence now? So I'm really following a lot of Jean-Pierre Borel's vascular work at the moment, and my mentor in that is a guy named Christoph Sommer. He's from Munich, Germany, and I'm really interested in blood flow and venous drainage and how it impacts neurodynamics. So I think neurodynamic mobility is more about venous congestion in the neurolemma, paraneurolemma, as opposed to just the myofascial interfaces. And so my current area of personal growth and investigation has been into understanding lymphatic and venous drainage through systems. It's a system I haven't paid a lot of attention to for 40 years, so time to dive into that one. So yeah, Christoph's big on my list at the moment. I follow a number of key researchers always, so Paul Hodges is one of them, and I'm certainly involved in following a lot of the work that Andre Vleming is doing as well. About it.
Okay. Now, I'm just out of curiosity, through all your years of experience and the things that you've learned and what you know now, what kind of things do you wish that you had known as a young clinician that you know now?
Oh my gosh. That you can't fix everybody. There's going to be some people that don't want to get better. To stay curious, don't be so hard on yourself in thinking about what went wrong or how come you couldn't get someone better, or particularly the most toxic thought a young clinician can have is somebody else could do this better than me. That, you know, we have the tools that we have, you offer them up, and if somebody reaches the limit of what you know, that it is truly okay to tell them that you know what? I don't know what else to do for you. And I surely hope that there's a pathway to recovery for you. I don't know where that is, but it's not here. So not to, you know, keep people coming back when you really don't know where you're going with them. Like, make a plan, have a plan, and when it doesn't work out, that's okay. They'll be learning in that.
Okay.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I've always really enjoyed it and had fun. Just the other day, I was back from a big teaching tour and jet lagged and tired and didn't want to go into work. I thought, you know, maybe it is time to pack it in. Grump, grump, look who's coming in today. And I get to work. Within two patients in, I'm going, gosh, this is great. I love what I do. This is fantastic. And so the work itself lifts you up. And then that's when you know, it's not time to retire yet.
Very true.
Yeah, very true.
No,
they're not all days are like that, but as long as most days are, then it's time to keep going, right?
Yep. Now, I was just curious, you know of Syriacs from your training, and I've asked other people this on interviews, but if there's, you know, one or two things that you could be remembered by in the world of manual physio, what might it be?
Oh, wow. Something that I'd like to be remembered by.
Remembered as or remembered by, anything.
Yeah. That This is a common line that I say in all my courses, and that I really feel that evidence-based practice is taken away from some clinicians, that you have permission to play, that the clinic is your lab, that your research lab is your treatment room, and play. Just be creative, be curious. The patient will always tell you, their body will always tell you if you're on the right track or not. And that it's okay to make things up. It really is. It doesn't have to have a protocol or a guideline or an RCT with a systematic review for this, that there are just some things that can't be researched. And as long as you're helping people feel better, move better, and improving the quality of their life, that it truly is a privilege to be part of that whole process and to honor that process, really. Yeah. But have fun at it while you're at it. Like, yeah.
Okay.
Just play. Just play. Play and be curious. And then the learning will always be there, right?
Perfect advice. Now, the next kind of question I have is, what is some of the either best or worst advice that you've heard given to others, or that you've either given yourself? And you just gave us some good advice, but anything else? Good or bad?
What is some of the best or the worst advice? Well, some of the best advice that I could give to somebody who is newly graduated is get yourself a mentor.
Yeah.
Find yourself someone that you want to be like when you grow up and spend as much time with them as you can. I think mentorship in early practice is really critical for expediting expertise. Like if you want to get comfortable in your practice. I remember in the first year working with Cliff, and he'd read an article and he'd say to me, I don't see this person in my practice that they're talking about. Do you? And I would look at him and reflect to myself and go, I haven't a clue what I see. I had no pattern recognition. I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't recognize anybody from reading an article. And, you know, that just takes time, right? That takes time. So yep. Get a mentor and somebody that can sort of guide where you're going with it. That's probably some really good advice. Some bad advice, I would think, would be to expect there to be a piece of evidence for every person that you see and everything you do. There won't be.
Yeah.
With that. And another piece of really good advice I got from David Butler 20 years ago was to take time to reflect at the end of every treatment session. So you really want to book your treatment sessions so that you stay on time and that you actually do your charting at the end of that session, and you save 5 minutes at the end of the session to do that, because that's where you have the time to reflect on what just happened. Because that's where things that maybe you missed or might have wanted to look at next time, or an idea will come. And it won't come at lunchtime when you're trying to even remember what you did. So to take the session isn't ended until you've actually reflected on it and had an idea in terms of where you're going. Now, obviously, that may change when they come back, but reflection time is critical for expediting expertise. Otherwise, you can be doing the same thing for 20 years and not be any further ahead. It's David's line. Versus you can get 20 years of experience in one. And the difference really is thinking about your thinking. What am I thinking and why? You know, having a reason for all the things that you're doing. No more guessing. There's no more guessing. Good hypothesis development is what you want to be developing.
Perfect. Now, we just have a couple more questions, Diane, so please just let me know if you got to go.
I'm okay for about 10 minutes.
Okay. So if you mentioned a few things earlier in our conversation, but if you want to expand on this or mention something else, if you could challenge others in your profession to something, be something, do something, what would it be and why?
Challenge others in my profession to be something, do something. Be a mentor. Take on the young. Like when you're starting to get 10, 13, 15 years into your practice and things are sliding a bit, you're no longer passionate about it, just going through the motions. Maybe you don't want to take more courses. Maybe it's not about you, but maybe it's about giving back to others. And it's so inspiring and learning to help the people who are coming behind us benefit from our experience. So offer up your help and your mentorship, for sure. The other thing in our profession is, and it's always what has to happen, is, you know, to get out into the community, offering our services to community sports teams, to dance teams, to senior citizens' homes, to whatever it is the group of people that you love to work with in the community. Just show the face of physical therapy in the community and who we are and what we represent for them. So be public. You know, support the upcoming people in your profession and support your community.
Okay. Now, if you had a choice to treat only one, and I know it's kind of hard to narrow it down from a clinical reasoning side, but if you could pick one battleground to treat on almost all patients that walk through your door, whether that's thorax, cervical spine, lumbopelvic girdle, hips, whatever, any particular area of the body that you see is dysfunctional enough that you would choose to work on almost every patient?
Abdominal wall. Yeah. It links the thorax to the pelvis. Without a functional abdominal wall, you can't hold up your thorax. Without a functional abdominal wall, you can't keep your organs in a good place, so it leads to prolapse, incontinence, it leads to thoracic pain, it changes head neck posture. The abdominal wall is not working well, your diaphragm goes low, pulls through the pericardium of your heart, your head goes forward. It pulls on the vagal nerve, the phrenic nerve, pulls through the dura, compresses the pelvic outlet, changes blood flow down to your lower extremity, causes all sorts of things. If you have a really good functioning abdominal wall, that means it's integrated to your pelvic floor, to your diaphragm, and to your thorax. You've got good posture, and if you have good alignment and good posture, then the rest of it is easy to come. It starts from the center. It is our center. I'd say the abdominal wall would be something that, now, how you get the abdominal wall functional may not be through training it. I mean, there's lots of ways to do it, but ultimately, I want a good abdominal wall. If I had to pick one area, I mean, obviously there's feet are important, head, everything is important.
Of course.
Across the board.
Okay, that's pretty fascinating. I look forward to learning more about that. Mm. Now, one last question. If you could just teach one thing to every patient that you see, what might it be?
If I could teach one thing, I would bring awareness into the body. I think Moshe Feldenkrais said it right. Awareness through movement, being aware of what you're eating, how you're sleeping, how you're drinking impacts your movement function. Being aware of how you're sitting, how you're driving, how you're golfing, the strategy you're using, the impact it has on your foot, your back, your neck. That listening to your body as you're doing things is going to take you much further than listening to what somebody else tells you about your body. Your body will tell you when you're doing things right if you listen. If you don't, it'll shut you down.
Perfect. Okay, Diane. What are some good ways that people can either learn more about you or learn what you're doing? Any websites or social media that you could direct us to?
So probably for physical therapists that are interested in more training in the approach and the courses, it would be my Learn website, which is just learnwithdianelee.com, learnwithdianelee.com, all lowercase. There's lots of free lectures, articles, resources there. There's online courses. It has my entire teaching schedule in terms of where I am. The DRA guide, the diastasis rectus abdominis guide, which is the abdominal guide that I wrote last year, is available there as well. The clinic website is just my name, dianelee.ca, and that's where you'll find a good group of us who practice in this model, the integrated systems model. That's where there are resources for patients and where people can come to book appointments and things like that. Those are probably the two best places.
Perfect.
My Facebook page is just Diane Lee PT, and I don't use Facebook personally. I just use it to let people know where we are. We're developing a YouTube channel, which is basically short video clips from the courses where people can actually see what we're teaching a little bit. Rather, sometimes reading what it's about just in the written form is difficult, but just sometimes watching some clips makes it fun. So that's coming soon. Mm-hmm. I think that's about it.
Great. Well, hey, thanks again. I certainly appreciate the time that you got to spend with us here. I look forward to seeing you again and hopefully be in one of your classrooms sometime in the future.
I look forward to it now. Sounds good.
All right. Well, take care. We'll look forward to speaking with you another time.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
Bye-bye.
Bye.